I'm Marty Moscoane. Welcome back to Radio Times. Both Michelle Obama and Ann Romney gave primetime speeches at the two conventions this year. Here's the First Lady speaking to an adoring room of Democrats.
He was still the guy who picked me up for our dates in a car that was so rusted out. I could actually see the pavement going by in a hole in the passenger side door. He was the guy whose proudest possession was a coffee table he'd found in a dumpster, and whose only pair of decent shoes was a half size too small.
And of course, the he was Barack Obama. Here's Ann Romney rallying GOP loyalists in support of her husband.
We got married and moved into a basement apartment. We walked to class together, shared the housekeeping, ate a lot of pasta and tuna fish. Our desk was a door propped up on sawhorses. Our dining room table was a fold-down ironing board in the kitchen. But those were the best days.
While Mrs. Obama and Mrs. Romney are different when it comes to their bios, they have similar jobs on the campaign trail, revealing the softer, more personal, more human sides of their husbands' personalities. Well, today in Radio Times, we're taking a look at how campaigns define and sometimes limit political wives. And we have two guests who have joined us by telephone. Libby Copeland is a writer, a regular contributor to Slate.com. And Libby Copeland, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Rebecca Tracer. She writes for Salon, covers things like women in politics, media, and entertainment. And Rebecca Tracer, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
It's great to be here, Marty.
Libby, let me begin with you. And even those two clips, which we played essentially back to back, and it sounds like, a competition between two candidates' wives about who had the greatest or the greater hardships when they were young and dating. What significance do you hear in that, Libby?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. There was a quote by Politico not too long before those speeches where they talked about the idea that both Ann Romney and Michelle Obama were obliged to, they said that Barack and Mitt were dependent on their wives to channel their feelings to voters, which made their wives sound almost like psychic mediums. And I think there's a certain amount of kind of, you know, this humanizing and softening, this idea that, you know, they're real people and they have actual hardships and real concerns. And I'm going to tell you about the things that actually go on when the doors close. Here's the guy, what he was like back when we didn't have a lot of money, whether or not that's entirely true in Mitt Romney's case. You know, here's the guy, what he was like when he was in his 20s or 30s. So there's this idea that, you know, the wife's role is to let you in on the real guy and how he really cares about Americans, kind of, you know, let you glimpse behind the curtain. And that's what those quotes and those speeches were all about.
And Rebecca, obviously at the conventions there were they were speaking to their supporters, but do you think that's an effective message in today's political world, whether you like it or not? Do you think it's an effective message?
Well, it's effective insofar as it's not distracting. One of the things we see, the packaging that Libby pointed to is absolutely right on. What we've seen is a bunch of very different women sort of stuffed in one very similar role. And the reason we have that role is so that it doesn't trouble us, right? So these women don't trouble us, especially the powerful or opinionated ones, like, for instance, Michelle Obama. And one thing, and so whether or not it's effective, is that really what we need to hear? Does it help us make our decisions about the candidates themselves? I don't know. Some people enjoy it. Certainly both women's speeches were received very well in the quarters they were supposed to be received well in.
Exactly.
So yes, in that it doesn't upset the balance. And one of the things that we need to remember when we talk about Michelle Obama in this role is that she did not start out this way. She really is somebody who was repackaged because her original persona on the campaign trail back in 2008 was not the sort of comfortably supportive, warm, fuzzy translator of her husband's feelings. She was much more opinionated on issues of American history. She said very funny things, sort of poking a hole in her husband's balloon of you know, self-confidence, and she got in a lot of trouble for that, for reasons that had a lot to do with both her being a powerful and opinionated woman and with race. There was a lot of racism and sexism aimed at her, and she wasn't playing a traditional role, and she got in a lot of trouble and had a lot of pushback, and she was repackaged into this much more comfortable figure.
Well, picking up on that, Libby Copeland, and this almost feels like ancient history, I'm thinking of that New Yorker cover of then-candidate Barack Obama and Michelle Obama fist bumping, and of course the comment when she said, you know, I'm finally proud of my country. She said it a little more elegantly than that. But do you think that the system sort of chastens these candidate wives so that they have to behave in a certain kind of way?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there was a moment when Michelle Obama was on the cover of the Weekly Standard, and I want to say it was 2007, 2008, and it was labeled Mrs. Grievance. Mm. And that sort of like encapsulated the whole kind of view of her back then. And when I look back at her 2008 convention speech, you know, she sort of was playing the similar role to she played in the 2012 speech. In other words, by the time the convention came around, she and the folks who worked with her had kind of figured it out. She was already calling herself Mom in Chief as far back as 2008. But there were moments earlier on the campaign trail, as Rebecca pointed out, when you could sort of see that learning process taking place. Mm-hmm. You could sort of see that, you know, she was figuring out precisely how constrained her kind of public persona needed to be, precisely which jokes she could and couldn't make about her husband, mostly couldn't make. You know, it's interesting for me to watch Ann Romney go through this. She is in many ways, you know, sort of potentially not as threatening to some folks' perceptions of the modern American woman. But, you know, at the same time, she doesn't have the snarkiness of Michelle Obama, for instance. There's not the race issue for her. But there are moments when I've seen Ann Romney get a little bit like maybe frustrated. Mm-hmm. You know, she at one point not too long ago said of her husband's detractors, you know, this is hard, you know, they should try it. I'm paraphrasing, you know, but, you know, this is hard, they should stop giving him a hard time. And you could sort of see that there's a brittleness there that any one of us, were we put in that position, would feel. The trick is that Michelle Obama's had additional time to kind of like rub away the hard edges of her public persona and get away from that brittleness. I mean, one of the things that I discovered when I wrote a piece about first ladies last month was that, you know, one of the most damaging things a first lady or a first lady candidate can be is angry or bitter. It's not quote unquote ladylike.
Interesting.
So they kind of have to work very hard to always be balanced, to always be sort of like on even keel. And I think that the ultimate best person at this, the best at maintaining this kind of false persona, was Laura Bush, of whom the Washington Times once wrote something along the lines of, she never has a bad day, which seemed to me like such an impossible, ridiculous statement, but it was presented utterly straight.
Well, and Libby, just because I have it in my fingertips here, yeah. Ann Romney said, stop it. This is hard. You want to try it? Get in the ring. This is hard. And one can understand her frustration, you know, helping her husband run for president of the United States. But Rebecca, it almost feels as if we have put these candidates' wives into some kind of weird amber, you know, that they're the wives of a generation ago.
Well, we have. But I think there are a lot of reasons for that. You're absolutely right. They have to fit an antiquated vision of what femininity is. And it's a vision in which the woman is ultimately subservient, in which she quashes all of her own identifying characteristics, whether it is her anger or her frustrations, which, by the way, I think we can all agree, everybody, you know, male and female, feels anger and frustration and has opinions, but also their own professional identities, their economic freedoms, their social freedoms, their commitments to their homes, their cities. I mean, the things that Michelle Obama now doesn't talk about that made up her life, this is completely anachronistic in a time when so many of the candidates' wives have educations and professions that are completely comparable with their husbands. Now, of course, we are largely talking here about husbands who are the candidates,
yes,
and their wives who are the first ladies. And so to ask them, to Michelle Obama never talks about her career. She and Barack Obama, as everybody knows, he was her assigned to her, she was his mentor at a law firm. They have absolutely comparable educations. And yet she never talks about her work. The sort of commitment to the city of Chicago, which she wound up leaving to come to Washington. We ask these women, and I think it's because it's not just about them individually, it's still about our discomfort with women who are increasingly post-second wave, equally empowered, who have comparable educations and careers to their husbands, who might even be qualified enough to be president. And in fact, we saw two women in the last election cycle, one running for president, Hillary Clinton, and Sarah Palin running for vice president. These things make us uncomfortable, and we're already dealing with, you know, discomfort about race. All kinds of people who have never run for office before are now either president, Barack Obama is our president, or within spitting distance. And so in the times in which we can revert back to a comfortable vision of femininity that doesn't threaten us, we do, because it makes us more comfortable. And that's what we're seeing in mm-hmm. these women being thrust into a time machine.
Well, and when we're talking about campaigns, I mean, this is not the real world. I mean, it's been going on for 2 years, but this isn't really how people live their lives. I guess just this unique group of people that are running for office. But do you think, Libby, by using Michelle Obama as an example, she's a Princeton, Harvard-educated woman, and she was, I think, the breadwinner for a while in her family. If she were to talk about that and talk less about being mom in chief, would that end up emasculating the president?
I mean, depends on who the audience is. Would it emasculate him for me? You know, maybe not. But I do think that, you know, her handlers have sort of made, you know, mm-hmm. and their advisors have sort of made a calculated sense of what's going to play. You know, what Rebecca said was right. There is no permissible way for a first lady to express ambition. The only permissible ambition that I've witnessed is ambition on behalf of her husband. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting, too, is there's been, if you look at the language of both Ann Romney and Michelle Obama's speeches and language in profiles that have been written about them and other first ladies and wannabe first ladies, you see over and over again a kind of fetishization of the language of sacrifice. So Michelle Obama sacrifices this and that for Barack Obama, and Romney has made many, many sacrifices, going all the way back to Laura Bush. Mm-hmm. And in their speeches, both Michelle and Anne talked about their sacrifice in kind of glorifying terms. So we've sort of gotten to this place where it's as if they've made this assumption that the American people want to hear about the First Lady's sacrifice. They want this somewhat, more than somewhat retrograde vision of womanhood in which, you know, the First Lady sort of lets go of her own desires on behalf of her husband and, more importantly, on behalf of the country. Well, she's doing this for all of us.
Let's take a very short break. We'll pick up on that, talking with Libby Copeland and Rebecca Traister about candidates' wives. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Fellowship for the Performing Arts, presenting The Screwtape Letters, a theatrical adaptation of the C.S. Lewis novel, at the Merriam Theater on October 19th and 20th. Tickets at screwtapeonstage.com.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You're listening to Radio Times, and that means you depend on WHYY to bring you news and information. We're talking about candidate wives and the roles that they play in campaigns, one of the many shows about this year's elections that we are featuring on Radio Times. Become a member supporter of WHYY by making a pledge right now. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Thomas Jefferson University Hospital supports WHYY and serves the entire Delaware Valley community, tackling problems that include high blood pressure, irregular heart rhythms, blocked arteries, and heart failure. Their Women's Heart Health website offers advice from the physicians at Jefferson Heart Institute on heart risk factors, working with your doctor, steps for healthier living, and more at jeffersonhospital.org/womenheart. Thomas Jefferson University Hospital.
WHYY is supported by Works For Me, funded by CMS grant CFDA number 93.768. Works For Me offers hiring tips, training, and help finding employees. Details at worksforme-pa.org/employer.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We're looking at the roles that presidential candidate wives are playing this year and have played in previous races. While the First Lady and Ann Romney couldn't be more different, why do they sound so alike? And our guests are Rebecca Traister. She writes for Salon, covering women in politics, media, and entertainment. Libby Copeland is a writer, regular contributor to Slate.com. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Rebecca, going back to you, I mean, the tricky thing, it seems to me, for a wife is that she's not running for president, at least not yet. And so it's a curious position for someone who obviously loves their husband, wants them to win. It's a curious and, I think, sometimes difficult role for them to be in, because we're not voting for them, even if we like or don't like them.
Right. And the interesting thing is that it is a role that is very traditional. You know, we have 200 years worth of first ladies, and we are always comparing our contemporary first lady candidates to those that came before. And yet, the sort of the very nature of marriage has changed so radically as women, especially women of the sort of class most likely to marry potential presidents, right? Women with access to education. You know, we now have a whole set of partners who have actually intellectual partnerships, who have political, ideological partnerships with their husband. This is something Bill Clinton first said in 92, where he advertised his very equal marriage with Hillary Clinton as, you know, two for the price of one. This did not actually go over very well.
No.
Because Hillary Clinton was, as the first lady to have had a postgraduate degree, and the first lady to have had a career outside of her husband's career, Hillary Clinton became this lightning rod of a figure. This was so distressing to the nation that we had this equally qualified, powerful, ambitious first lady, that she became a lightning rod figure. Now, interestingly, it wasn't just about Hillary as an individual. It was that she represented this massive shift for how women could be, what they could be, and the kind of partnerships they might have with their husband, where plausibly, if their husband was going to be president, they might have equally valid ideas and conversations with him about policy, about how to run the country. Since Hillary was the first of three in a row to have postgraduate degrees. Laura Bush also had a Master's of Library Science. Michelle Obama, of course, has a law degree from Harvard. And many of the other, Judy Steinberg Dean, Howard Dean's wife, was a doctor. You know, Teresa Hines Carey had an advanced degree. Elizabeth Dole went to Harvard Law School. This was representative of a massive generational break in which many of the first ladies were going to have this kind of potentially equal intellectual partnership. So what do you do? You're right. The first lady is not running the country.
Right.
But if she has a marriage that is in part a partnership of ideas and perhaps even ideology, then what she thinks and what she believes could potentially come to bear on her husband's ideas, because it may be a partnership of intellectual equals.
And one would assume that behind the scenes she probably exerts a lot of influence on her husband. Let me go back to you and whether you think there has at least been a slow evolution. I think Eleanor Roosevelt was probably the exception to the rule. But nonetheless, it seems like other first ladies were basically, you know, seen but not heard. And I think more and more we see the candidates' wives out making speeches on the trail, not talking just about recipes and chocolate chip cookies and being moms. But at least venturing a little bit into policy and issues. Do you see some evolution there?
I do, but it's been sort of a very slow, slow, painfully slow sometimes evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And the language is often couched in such a way as to be not threatening. So, you know, yes, the First Lady can have an opinion. Mind you, it should be precisely her husband's opinion as well, so it must be in keeping with his. But, you know, she's not going to take on a platform that's going to be, you know, particularly
provocative. It's going to be, you know, as with Michelle Obama, it's going to be, you know, the nation's obesity crisis and the need for eating organic food, which is totally worthy, but also safe. And I'm not criticizing her for that. I think there's a certain amount of, you know, sort of testing the waters and knowing what's, you know, sort of what's going to work and what she can do. But there is this kind of conundrum, you know, as Rebecca pointed out, which is that, you know, the First Lady is not elected. And so, you know, voters may not want two for the price of one. They may want the husband. But what happens is that because the First Lady is not elected and yet she is brought along, what winds up happening is it sort of reinforces those traditional, that very traditional marriage. Because it's almost always the man who's the candidate, there's this reinforcement of sort of this very old kind of marriage where the First Lady leaves her life behind. She leaves her job if she happens to have one. She focuses all her energies on, you know, her children and when they first go into office, relocating her children, which was what Michelle Obama talked about a lot, and sort of like giving up herself to this role. That is what you would expect a husband to do if a woman became president, for sure. But it hasn't worked out that way. And so as a result, you have this scenario that continually kind of reinforces this very kind of like old-fashioned marriage.
Well, and even picking up on what was said earlier about Hillary Rodham Clinton when she was the First Lady, Rebecca, and President Clinton at the time gave her the responsibility of coming up with some reform of health care. Now, I think it was criticized for process and a whole host of other issues related to what she came up with. But nonetheless, it's hard to imagine any president today giving their spouse that kind of responsibility.
Well, we have to see these things as reactions, right? And that's because of Hillary and then, in fact, because of her later career, because she went on to run for president, because that's upending to us, right? Part of what we see is a reaction to that, which is pushing women back into traditional roles. A lot of the regress that we're noting is a reaction to progress, right? That's part of how it works. So there's a pushback to Hillary. And that's what we're seeing. I also want to note, because we do keep talking about Michelle Obama's mom and chief role as a sort of sad regression, and I have written about it that way. And it has often been pointed out to me, and this is a really important point, that we cannot take race out of this. And Michelle and Barack Obama are incredible historic figures. They are our first black president and first lady. And among the things, when Michelle Obama is celebrated as a mother and celebrates herself as a mother, she's actually doing something that is extremely interesting and powerful, because in the white cultural imagination, we have seen so few models for idealized black motherhood. That when she presents herself that way, there is something exciting and progressive about it. And that has been pointed out to me several times when I have critiqued this sort of reduction of self, you know, taking away her work and her other interests and presenting herself only as a mother. We have to remember that we are in the midst of making remarkable history here, and that Michelle Obama is playing a really unique role and balancing a lot of expectations and a lot of forms of resistance, and that the presentation of Michelle in ways that perhaps we see as traditionally feminine, not only as a mother but as a sort of fashion plate and a sort of sartorial ideal, these are actually exciting and powerful images for black women who have very rarely gotten to see themselves in the largely white cultural imagination celebrated for being fashion plates, for being mothers.
So the idea,
we have to remember that when we talk about this stuff too.
So the idea, as she says, of being mom in chief, that might be almost as powerful as saying I'm commander in chief.
Yes, it's very powerful. We have so few, there are so few positive images of black women that have historically been widely presented. And one of the ways that she got pigeonholed back when she was at the start of the 2008 campaign, when she was speaking her mind and talking more about issues and talking more frankly and making jokes about her husband and all that, was that she immediately got stereotyped as one of the stereotypes of black femininity that was more pervasive, which is the angry black militant woman and the sort of emasculating black woman. And she got stereotyped that way in very public places, like in Maureen Dowd's column in the New York Times in 2008. She immediately was pigeonholed into a negative black stereotype. And so there's something that she's doing as First Lady when she presents herself as this terrific mother that is, in fact, very progressive in its own right. And that's different from what it would mean if it were a white professional woman for whom there have been many, many, historically many more sort of elevations of white maternal idealization. What she's doing is very different.
That's Rebecca Traister, who joins us along with Libby Copeland, and we are talking about candidates' wives, specifically Michelle Obama and Ann Romney, talking about the roles the candidates' wives have played and are playing in the presidential campaign. We'd be interested in your thoughts, observations, comments. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, looks like Diane from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us. Diane, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning. My comment just was, it would be interesting to see when Barack Obama gets reelected, if Michelle actually lets her personality bloom in the areas which she has sort of suppressed. You know, I agree with the guest said about her being very influential in the black community, portraying, you know, the woman that she is, but her intellectual side has still kind of been put on the back burner. And it'll just be interesting to see that, because he will not be running again in the future, that she will be able to kind of come into her own without a threat to his political career.
Well, it's interesting, Diane. Let me see what Libby Copeland has to say. And, of course, we'll know in 3 weeks and one day the answer to that question. But nonetheless, do you understand what Diane is at least it sounds like what she's hoping for?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I don't think that should Barack Obama be reelected that all of a sudden we'll turn around and Michelle will, you know, change radically back to, you know, her older persona. I mean, I think part of it is, I don't think it's fair necessarily to see this as, you know, there's this real Michelle Obama or this real Ann Romney, and they kind of fake it on the campaign trail. I mean, there's a certain amount of that, you know, kind of putting on a game face and all that. But I also think that, you know, Michelle Obama has become politically savvy, and Ann Romney as well. You know, I just think that you probably have a sense after doing this for a while of kind of like what plays on the bigger stage.
Right.
You know, certain things play, and, you know, I don't know that there's necessarily going to be, you know, all of a sudden she's going to come out and start giving her own opinions in contrast, you know, in ways that contrast with her husband's, if only because, as Rebecca said earlier, you know, that would be very distracting. And it, you know, there's just simply too much for the media to kind of like pick up on and talk about and analyze that would take away from her husband's, you know, agenda and what he's trying to get done. So I think it's pretty unlikely, but I do think it's possible that I believe I heard that she was writing a book. Oh. I'm not sure about that, but that sounds like it's coming up from the recesses of my mind. I'm sure she'll write a book.
Interesting. Let me see what Cynthia from Langhorne has to say. And Cynthia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I'm calling about the mom in chief comment.
Yes.
Yes, I bristle when I hear that, because I know she's so much more. I was raised by both parents who were feminists, a mother and a father, and I just hear that, and I know that like she's told to say that, even though she might feel that. There's so much more to her, and I never had a problem with her before she was repackaged, but I know I'm in the minority of thinking that, and I know she has to be a generic version of, you know, what a candidate's wife should be and then what a first lady should be.
But you bristle anyway, Cynthia, even if you understand the politics of it?
I understand the politics of it, and then I also, you know, go back and realize about how with the race issue and how it is good. Mm-hmm. I was a high school teacher for a while, and I taught some in some, you know, urban situations, so I see the value of her. But I also know that women can be both. We can be everything. Pigeonholing is, I long to see the day when we progress past it.
Well, Cynthia, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I'm sure, Rebecca, you share her hopes and dreams as well.
I do share her hopes and dreams. And, you know, again, I'm not making an excuse for it, but we have to remember that part of our frustrations here are because women are making so much progress. Michelle Obama is a historic and exciting figure and a very powerful figure. I will even put in a supportive and defensive plug for the gardening stuff, which a lot of people sort of say, oh, and now she's in the garden and she does food stuff. That actually has been a very smart way. It's easily reduced to a feminine thing. Oh, she's hanging out in the garden with kids. But in fact, when you get to food politics in this country, what you're talking about are real issues of class and often of race and, you know, people's access to good, healthy food and health care. And so even through that, which we often sort of say, oh, she's done this boring thing, this typically feminine thing, it actually, I think that it is one of the ways that she has been able to subtly express her own investments in community and class issues. And, you know, so she's in there. She's in there, this powerful, smart person. She's in there. And Libby is completely right that the mom stuff is also very authentic. Anybody who's ever known Michelle Obama knows that she has always been very passionate about her kids, about her motherhood, about her marriage. It's just that it's the not being allowed to hear the rest of it is the problem. It's not that she has been remade. It's that part of it, part of herself, part of her opinions, her job, her identity, we are not allowed to hear about anymore, and we only hear about the comfortable domestic stuff. But I do think that even in things like the gardening, that ambitious, interested, opinionated, committed political mind is still in there.
Cynthia, thanks for the call. Let me squeeze Anne from Princeton on the air. Anne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. My question is just, do you think it would have been a lot easier for a Republican first lady, an ambitious one, or at least, you know, a professional one. I mean, I know that there's Laura Bush, but somebody who challenged the traditional mold of the first lady, would she have had a better reception? Do you feel that the people who are providing a lot of the resistance to powerful first ladies are Republicans, and that if it had been, say, Mrs. Dole or another woman with a, you know, for instance, a degree that's not a traditionally woman's degree, like a library degree, do you think they would have had an easier time of it?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm going to toss it to Libby Copeland. Libby, we have about a minute before our second break here. Go ahead.
I love that question. I think it's really interesting. And I think, actually, it's instructive to look back at Liddy Dole because, you know, part of what she did was she was very ambitious, but she packaged herself in a very safe way. She was said to be a steel magnolia. You know, that kind of quiet toughness, I actually think that in some cases, what you see some of this Democratic first ladies and running, you know, wives have kind of figured out that that is a permissible way to present their ambitions. They can be sort of ambitious on behalf of their husbands. They can be sort of ambitious so long as they kind of soften it with a kind of sweet ladylike quality. But they can't speak in certain ways that maybe are too polarizing or too tough or too frustrated or too angry with the state of the country. So I do think it's possible that a Republican first lady could get away with being more ambitious, but not because simply because she might sort of be better able to couch it in language that's sort of more permissible, that sort of plays better.
Well, let's take a very short break, and that's Libby Copeland. I'm sure Rebecca Tracer wants to respond to that as well. And thanks for calling into Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Widener Law allows the flexibility to schedule classes by offering day, evening, and online courses. Classroom learning is reinforced with hands-on experience through clinics, practical skills training, and more. And with a campus located in Delaware, the corporate capital, Widener Law may offer a unique advantage. An information session will be held Saturday, October 20th from 9:45 a.m. to 1 p.m. on the Delaware campus. Information session details online at law.widener.edu for October 20th. Widener supports WHYY.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You're listening to Radio Times, and that means you depend on WHYY to bring you news and information. We're talking about candidate wives and the roles that they play in campaigns, one of the many shows about this year's elections that we are featuring on Radio Times. Become a member supporter of WHYY by making a pledge right now. Call 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Phoebe specializes in healthcare, housing, and support services for senior adults. From independent living to rehabilitation services and skilled nursing, Phoebe offers continuing care retirement communities in Lehigh, Berks, Bucks, and Montgomery counties. On November 2nd, Phoebe presents the Institute on Aging Conference, featuring keynote speaker Larry Minix, CEO of Leading Age. The conference focuses on reclaiming advocacy duties to benefit seniors in our communities. Details at phoebe.org. Phoebe Ministries supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. With a close and closely watched presidential race, the Obama and Romney campaigns are using their secret weapons, their wives, or I should say the candidates' wives. Ann Romney was in Pennsylvania yesterday while Michelle Obama was in Ohio, and just 3 weeks until Election Day. We're talking about and taking a look at how campaigns define and sometimes limit political wives. And we have two guests who have joined us by telephone. Rebecca Traister writes for Salon. She's a journalist who covers women in politics, media, and entertainment. Libby Copeland is a writer and a regular contributor to Slate.com, was a reporter at the Washington Post for 11 years. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Rebecca, do you want to take the call we had right before the break?
Yes,
wondering whether
such a fascinating question.
Yeah, go ahead.
And Elizabeth Dole is one of the most interesting figures in this conversation, because just as a reminder, so Bob Dole ran against Bill Clinton in 1996. His wife, Elizabeth Dole, who, as I think I mentioned before, had a Harvard law degree, she had been Secretary of Transportation in the Reagan administration. She'd been Secretary of Labor during the first Bush administration. She had run the Red Cross. She would later be a senator and go on to run for president. So we are talking about, you know, she's absolutely comparable to, say, a Hillary Clinton here.
Right.
And she is a Republican. And what she did at the 1996 convention, I think actually ushered in the culture of sort of feminizing what Libby was talking about earlier and that she wrote about in her Slate piece about the sort of women translating their husbands' feelings. I think Elizabeth Dole could reasonably be credited as the creator of that contemporary vision of women as the soft translators. She went out into the crowd in the 1996 Republican convention with a microphone and was widely compared to Oprah. And it was this, and then Hillary, I believe, did something similar in response. I can't quite remember what Hillary's action was, but Hillary played a similar role in her convention this year. And so here were these super powerful women, and she made it this sort of go out, talk to the crowd, talk about feelings, humanize the guy, and that was the strategy employed. This is when I keep talking about when we have powerful women, there's the resistance to that, and we see the sort of traditionalizing of the role. I actually think that Elizabeth Dole is a great example of that. That's how she couched her own power and ambition within that partnership, is by becoming a comfortable, very feminized, Oprah-ish figure. And you could also hear Oprah under the tones of Ann Romney during this convention. You could hear she often sounded like Oprah, like, I love women. I mean, she had almost the intonations of Oprah. And so that's sort of a mode that we have begun to find comfortable for First Lady candidates. The talking, feeling, emoting, communicating, talking with people role. And I believe it would be fair to say that Elizabeth Dole, super powerful, ambitious spouse, might be the architect of that role for contemporary first ladies.
So, Libby Copeland, think Oprah Winfrey when we're thinking about role models or how first ladies operate or candidates' wives operate?
I love that. I think that's brilliant. You're absolutely right, Rebecca. Yeah, no, Elizabeth was like, I think they called her like a softening agent, as if she was something that you would put in with the laundry. She was somebody who was supposed now, and the funny thing is, like, the candidates, no matter how different they are from one another, are inevitably described as deficient in some way. So in being able to communicate in some way, no matter how
great a communicator they're considered to be, right? So Obama is aloof, and Mitt Romney is stiff, and Bob Dole was kind of like creaky and stiff and not terribly emotive. You know, I said, I think at the top of the hour that there's some degree of like psychic medium going on. The wives are supposed to like somehow have this magical ability to, you know, kind of translate right. and, you know, and soften and all this stuff. And, you know, there's another aspect to this, which I find hilarious, and this often shows up in profiles of first ladies, and that's this idea that on the campaign trail, they perform this necessary but very mysterious process of soothing their husbands and calming their husbands. So, like, I think Ann Romney said the other day that her job was to offer peace and calm to Mitt, and she said, you know, I'm not going to talk to him necessarily about policy. He's got enough of that. But, you know, I consider it my role to offer peace and calm. And when the profile writers ask, you know, how do you do that? How do you manage this mysterious process? You know, it'll be kind of like, well, I don't know. It's sort of a magical thing. Like, right. aides will often feed these little anecdotes. Oh, she's, you know, John McCain was said to love that Cindy's mere presence could make him feel calm, as if he were like a wild beast who needed his trainer nearby. Like, it's really bizarre. When you ask precisely what she's doing, that's never spoken of, possibly because aides don't want to talk about whether or not the First Lady is actually influencing policy and actually having an opinion. That would be a step too far.
Well, I even remember 4 years ago when Barack Obama was running for president, interviewing journalists and saying that when Michelle was around, he seemed calmer. You know, he was,
yes.
I mean, whether he was a caged beast, I don't know, but he just seemed like he was his more mellow self on the trail. And, you know, frankly, these schedules are so grueling. You know, it seems to me that they're allowed to have some kind of softening, whether it's a, you know, something to use in the detergent or whether it's their spouse by their side. Let me get to Barbara from Maple Glen to join us. And Barbara, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
This is a great conversation. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I take umbrance with the word just. Michelle Obama is just a mom in chief, or she's just in the garden. I think it's short-sighted. That she's a very smart and powerful and savvy woman, and I disagree that we can be everything. Just we can only be something some of the time.
Oh dear, and it sounds like someone needs you, Barbara.
What we're doing, and I think that she chooses what she does. She can't choose to do every single thing.
Right. Well, sounds like you're a mom in chief as well. I'm going to let you go and deal with your child there. Rebecca, anything you want to add to what Barbara said?
Well, I mean, I think I would support the idea that just mom in chief is not. Obviously, there's a lot to being a mother, and I, you know, as I mentioned before, I think that's a very real commitment that she has. Again, it's the absence of the other stuff. I want to go back to the notion, Libby's very smart observation about the softening agent. This is actually a very old way of containing femininity, which is, it goes back to the cult of domesticity, in which the woman's role is supposedly the sort of civilizing of the wild male.
Right.
And this is a very old mode of understanding and being able to appreciate a woman's power, is if she can soften, civilize, essentially domesticate the man and offer him comfort, softness, the domestic arts, and thus ease his path back into the wild public world, in which is his natural environment. I mean, so what we hear now in our, you know, in 2012 and 2008 and 2004, as we talk about these women with advanced degrees and careers and money, and, you know, Cindy McCain, who had an enormous fortune and is a businesswoman. You know, the women who have all kinds of public power, we are still talking about them in a sort of 200-year-old cult of domesticity way, that is a very traditional way of comfortably celebrating a woman's role.
Barbara, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Talking with Rebecca Traister and Libby Copeland, we're talking about candidates' wives on the campaign trail, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What have you observed, and what, if anything, would you like these candidates' wives to say or do? Libby, this is a bit of a thought experiment, because we don't, at least we almost did 4 years ago, but we don't have a woman running for president. president, and we don't have the thought of what to do about her husband. But do you think that a husband would be put into a similar kind of straitjacket?
Boy, no, I don't think that necessarily her husband would have to kind of soften himself in quite the same way. But I do think what a first husband would have to do would be to, like a first lady, he would be obliged to make sure that all his opinions were in conformity with his wives, which makes complete sense, right? You know, you got the president, you know, everyone's on the same team. You want to hear one message. So that would be for sure the case. And I think the other thing is he would be expected to keep kind of a supportive role, a relatively low-profile role in terms of pursuing his own interests. Now, I think a major question would be, could a first husband keep his own job? And I have a feeling that it would be a little bit easier for a first husband to keep his own job, you know, if his wife became president. And I think that would be a key difference there. I think there would be a little bit more freedom for him to sort of absent himself from the campaign trail and do his own thing, that he would not be sort of expected to be constantly in this kind of support role, this kind of like propping up role, this humanizing role. He would definitely not be called upon to translate her feelings to voters. He would be seen, that would be seen as kind of possibly silly or beneath him or something he simply would not be capable of doing.
What's your thought, Rebecca Traister?
Well, I think we actually have seen a very dramatic example of this because Hillary Clinton's run for president happened over a very long time and she had a very high-profile husband. And funnily enough, there was a small bit of reversal in that Hillary was seen as the more wooden candidate, the one who had a harder time communicating, and Bill was the great emoter. So there was some thought for a long time that he was going to be out there connecting to voters. Now, that campaign, you know, was a wild and crazy ride during which all kinds of things went awry. But one of the things that I wrote about this leading into 2008, Bill Clinton was actually very beautifully positioned to be the first man. He had worked on this Clinton Foundation and sort of was going around the world as an ambassador, which is a role that we can accept first ladies in. Eleanor Roosevelt did it. Hillary did it. It's something that we've grown comfortable with. In fact, if the partner is out there communicating with the rest of the world. And Bill Clinton, essentially in his post-presidency, had worked out a role for himself where that was his job through his Clinton Foundation, was traveling around the world and being an ambassador and a representative. So that I think he could have quite easily transitioned into that role and played a role that had historical precedent. He actually told me in 2007 that he would be proud to follow in the footsteps of Hillary and Eleanor Roosevelt in exactly that capacity. So that was an example of how it might have worked.
And we're almost up on a break here, but Libby, I mean, would you like a first lady to talk about Libya or the fiscal cliff or, you know, all the issues that are so important this election season?
I could see a future first lady where that would be possible, but that seems not like something that's going to happen in the immediate future. And I do think there is, there's very much a place for a first lady to talk about those difficult, complicated, thorny issues, as I said, so long as she sort of like hews to, you know, this kind of what the presidential line is. But I think there's also a certain amount of backlash that could take place if people say to themselves, well, we did not elect this particular person. We elected her husband. And so I think, you know, and some of that is legitimate. Some of that is legitimate. Until we can come up with, you know, sort of dual running teams where they're running literally as co-presidents, I do think that some people will object to the first lady being too influential in policy. And I think that if were the situation reversed and the president were a woman, I think that same thing could be objected to in a man, and that might be a fair objection for some folks to make.
And that's Libby Copeland, who joins us along with Rebecca Traister. I'm Marty Moscow, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get Joe from Chester County to join us. And Joe, go ahead. You're on the air. Go ahead, Joe.
Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I think this conversation is completely selling first ladies down the road. I mean, I'm sure Martha Washington had influence over George Washington before he was president picking generals. I'm sure we all know Abigail Adams wasn't a shrinking violet. Certainly Eleanor Roosevelt wasn't. The first lady is the president's chief consultant. And you know at night, we all know in the marriage dynamic, there's no way you can tell me that they don't talk about things that are troubling the president during the day. So it does matter who the first lady is, and it does matter what her political viewpoints are.
Well, Joe, it's a great point. And Rebecca and Libby, we're almost out of time, but let me give you each just 30 seconds response to Joe's comment saying, hey, of course she's important. She's the number one advisor, whoever the president is.
I don't think that we have disagreed with that. I think that I very much agree that it's important. I think that the discussion that we're having is about the public presentation of that role or the power of that role or the influence of a spouse, which is very different from what the private reality might be. And I think we're discussing the gap between that private reality versus the public presentation. So I don't think we're in disagreement with Joe.
Libby, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'd piggyback on that and just say, what Rebecca said is precisely right, and it's very telling that we are saying, well, we assume that they have those conversations, but that, in fact, when they're asked about them, they can't actually talk about those conversations because the public presentation of it is we are always in agreement, and, she soothes and calms me, but, you know, there's not that kind of public acknowledgement that she is his consultant. So even though that's going on behind the scenes, there's no public acknowledgement of it because that would be a step too far. And that's what's really telling about sort of what lacks in our understanding of the public presentation of the First Lady.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Libby Copeland, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
And Rebecca Tracer, as always, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
And that's Rebecca Tracer. She writes for Salon, covering things like women in politics, media, and entertainment. And Libby Copeland is a writer and a regular contributor to Slate.com. And in fact, we found their articles as we were noodling around the internet. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Green. Bomb, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. Assistance today from Jared Brausch. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.